It's a particular pleasure for me to be here this evening. This is actually my 40th year of teaching at the University of Virginia Law School. I started out and still do teaching the Civil Liberties Seminar, one session only, 40 years ago. So I think I outrank a number of the faculty here. I've been wondering, Mimi, is there such a thing as common law tenure? I've been hoping for that. A second reason I'm delighted to be here is because my colleague Dick Merrill is here this evening. I have to say one thing. Many people say that Dick towers over the field of academic food and drug law. Actually, that's wrong. He is the entire field of academic food and drug law. He has, for Lord knows how many decades now, set a standard for food and drug law in academia that is unequaled by anyone. There is no number two in the field. He is truly an institution and has contributed more than I can possibly say. I will say personally, I would never have done the casebook if Dick had not agreed to do it. So it's always a pleasure to be with him. I'm going to talk this evening about FDA as an institution rather than about specific battles won or lost. Dick and I always say, incidentally, the case book is filled with all the cases we lost. But I want to start out and give you a little bit of history about FDA as an institution, because one has to look considering the report that I recently made to the FDA Science Board, one has to understand the background and ask the question, how did FDA get in the difficult situation that it is today? You start with the fact that food and drug law is the oldest form of government regulation of business in recorded history. There has never been a recorded civilization under which there was no form of regulation of food and drugs. Indeed, for up until about 1850, all food was used for drugs and vice versa. In short, all drugs until about 1850 were made from natural materials, animal, plant, mineral, whatever. I'm always reminded that in the Roman Empire, the single most important drug was pepper, something that we now use as a condiment. So one has to look back in history. Where did FDA emerge from? And why did it emerge? You'll be amused to know that it came from a very unsuspected place, the United States Patent Office. In the 1830s, the Patent Office was confronted with large numbers of new seed products and asked to please, would they patent them? So they had no expertise in any kind of plant material. In those days, there was no Department of Agriculture. There was no locus in the federal government through which there could be any, if you will, regulation of any kind of the food and drug supply. So Patent Office began to be concerned about that, and in 1848, they created an agriculture division. That agriculture division then learned that in order to regulate any or to understand the nature of materials being sent in to be patented, they needed a chemical laboratory. That chemical laboratory was established, and the first chemical analyst was hired somewhere between 1858 and 1860. That first analyst was the first member of what we now call our Food and Drug Administration. Because in 1862, when Congress created the United States Department of Agriculture, they did so by taking that agriculture division of the Patent Office and literally just saying, we're renaming you the Department of Agriculture. That chemical laboratory became the chemical division of the department. And in 1902, it became the Bureau of Chemistry. In 1927, the Food, Drug, and Insecticide Administration. And in 1930, it finally achieved its current name, the Food and Drug Administration. Now, at that time, it was still located in the Department of Agriculture, which explains, and this is very important, why to this day, the Food and Drug Administration appropriations all go through the Appropriations Committee for Agriculture. They are not a part of the health budget. They're a part of the agriculture budget. So that FDA is fighting for appropriations each year against the agriculture department, which, needless to say, has a very strong constituency throughout the country. In 1939, all that changed. FDA was plucked out of the Department of Agriculture and put in an organization that virtually none of you have ever heard of, the Federal Security Agency, which was largely comprised of the Social Security Administration, but included a few other miscellaneous pieces as well. It was sort of a potpourri. They threw a bunch of agencies into this new one. And then in 1953, all of that was taken together and put into the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW. Some of you will remember HEW. When education was taken out in 1979, that then became the Department of Health and Human Services. And that is where FDA resides today. So that gives you some idea. But the important thing to take out of all this is that FDA is our oldest federal regulatory agency by almost a century. When you think of other federal regulatory agencies, of EPA, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, other agencies of that kind, health and safety agencies, they've all been created since 1970. We have FDA employees who've served in the agency for 45 years. That's not uncommon. People spend their entire careers at FDA. I'm reminded that one commissioner, George Larrick, who retired in 1966, started out as a GS-1. Did they still have GS-1s in the federal government? I'm not sure. But he spent his entire life. He came straight out of college to be an inspector and worked his way up to being commissioner. Now, of course, that has become a political job. There have been, over the years, a number of independent reviews of FDA of the kind that we've just gone through in the past few months. Each of them has been quite important and quite searching, but it's difficult to say just how much of an impact they have had, and that is one of the things that concerned us about this very recent review. There was one in 1955, and that the timing of that is important to understand. I'll give you the timing of each one of these reviews. 1955 was, of course, just after World War II, and it was just before what the transformation of the United States Food and Drug Administration from an agency that did nothing but policing to an agency that did pre-market approval right across the board for food additives, color additives, new drugs, and other products. So it was at the time of, and incidentally, my friend Dick has written the definitive article. The first words are the architecture of, what's the rest of the name of the article, Dick?
Regulating medical products.
Yes, the architecture of the regulation of medical products, in which he traces the history of this and points out that the fundamental difference of how a statute is constructed has such a huge impact on how the government agency itself functions and regulates. When you move from simple policing, where the Congress has determined since 1906 that the adulteration and misbranding of food and drugs is illegal, all that says is FDA is a traffic cop. And if a product goes through a red light, so to speak, it gets arrested, namely it gets seized or there's criminal action taken against it. That's totally fundamentally different from our world today, where you can't put a new product on the market without FDA review and approval. This is a huge dichotomy. So the 1955 report on FDA looked at the old FDA as it was about to emerge into the new one. The second report was in 1962. The important thing to remember about 1962, and it's embedded in my mind, I assure you, I started practicing food and drug law in early 1962. And I'll never forget picking up the Sunday newspaper on July 15, 1962, where Morton Mintz broke the story of thalidomide. Huge headlines. Half the front page was the story about that tragedy. We had escaped it in our country because of the work of Dr. Frances Kelsey. Let me just say one word about Frances. She's still working at FDA in her 90s. No joke. The agency's never going to let her retire. She is the only person in the history of FDA who ever won a gold medal from the president. And she did so by misinterpreting the scientific data. She's the first one to say this. She thought that thalidomide was a neurotoxin. It turned out that instead it harmed the fetus. But she did the right thing for the wrong reason. And let me tell you, in life, doing the right thing is more important than having the right reason. So she kept it off the market with a creative bureaucratic technique, the kind of thing that FDA reinvents every day when it needs something new. She couldn't say, she had the right, the legal right, to refuse to allow thalidomide on the market. She could have said, I veto your new drug application. She didn't say that. She kept saying, your new drug application is incomplete. It doesn't have enough data to satisfy me on safety. She said it over and over again until it was discovered that, in fact, this was a extraordinarily toxic drug. So the second report was 1962. It was right in the middle of the thalidomide tragedy, and the report said, basically, we have to prepare the Food and Drug Administration for what is going to come. The third report was in 1991, the same year, Dick, as our second edition of our casebook. And that report, like the other two, said, and I think any report at any time would say this, science is changing, and the Food and Drug Administration has to keep up with modern science because FDA is a science-based regulatory agency. It is not any longer just a law enforcement agency. You can't just go out and bring seizures and criminal action if you're going to enforce this statute. You need a, because of the advent now of pre-market approval, you need people trained in every scientific discipline. And they have to be right at the top of the field because these are the products that are going to appear before FDA. FDA is reviews every day the cutting edge of science. These are the important new things that we expect them, obviously, to review and approve immediately. You know, the artificial heart, the automatic defibrillator, all of these products that are advancing, new cancer drugs, new AIDS drugs, things that are genuinely life-saving. And that was, I might say, an excellent report. Now, why another report at this stage? It's interesting, the politics of reports are fascinating. They are just, they're part of the fun of being involved in the process. This started 4 years ago. And it started because FDA Commissioner Kessler, back in about 1990, decided that he wanted a science board, an advisory committee of top-flight scientists in the country who could advise him on broad scientific issues. There's only one problem with that concept. FDA itself doesn't deal with conceptual scientific issues, and it does no scientific research whatever. That's NIH. What FDA does is take that other science and regulate. So for a long time, the FDA Science Board, in a sense, didn't know what it was there for. It had no mission. It wasn't focused on any specific FDA project. But they finally decided about 4 years ago, let's review the entire state of science at the Food and Drug Administration today. Now, when you go to an FDA commissioner and say that, it strikes terror into the heart of the commissioner. Because the commissioner knows that no matter who looks at FDA, that they're going to find problems. Otherwise, why would they look? It's sort of like a law school having a visiting committee report. You know they're going to find things that aren't quite what they ought to be, even though the dean at the time is convinced it's the best law school in the country. I say this with great humor because I sat on the last visiting committee at the University of Virginia and had a most enjoyable time doing it. I'll let it go at that. I'll let Dick respond if he wants to later. Now, it took 4 years for a commissioner to agree to have the science board do this job. And finally, about a year ago, a committee was convened. As with all these committees, there is always a charter. It is always written in nebulous terms. You're never quite sure what the charter is, except this one was crystal clear in one respect, which, as I will point out in a moment, I immediately ignored. It said, you're only to look at the science. This is not a review of budget and appropriations. Well, in a sense, they made a mistake because that just was a challenge. At the first meeting of the committee, a number of important things turned up. The first was that no one had thought that we should be chartered under the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So I asked the first question. I said, are we a legal committee? And of course, everyone said, oh, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. They still haven't figured out, as of today, exactly. Those of us who participated, we're sometimes called consultants, we're sometimes called committee members, we're sometimes called volunteers. They have no idea what our committee was doing. We were never officially signed up. We just showed up at meetings and opined, which was actually not all bad because it meant we weren't under any kind of ridiculous restrictions. At the first meeting, I looked around the room. Believe it or not, there were 33 members of the committee. There were 32 distinguished scientists and one regulatory lawyer, me. So I said at the first, and incidentally, when I say distinguished scientists, one Nobel Prize winners, more than a third of the committee was a member of the National Academy of Sciences. The former and first Assistant Secretary for Safety of the United States Department of Agriculture, etc. These people were just superb. Anybody would say, that's a great committee. But at the first meeting, I looked at my 32 colleagues and said, I'm not a scientist. You deal with the science. But if we don't deal directly with the resources that the agency has, then this is useless. This is going to be some, you know, dense report about scientific capability and the latest issue in proteomics and genomics and everything else and IT infrastructure, and people's eyes will glaze over. We've got to make this come alive. We've got to look at what FDA has and how they can deploy it against whatever scientific challenges there are that exist. Now, the commissioner immediately pointed out that was not within our charter, but since the committee wasn't a lawful committee, that didn't bother me very much. The most I could do was get fired. I am always reminded every time I got in trouble when I was at FDA, I would sit there and think, you know, if they fire me right now, I'll go back to Covington and Burling and earn five times as much money. And that really wasn't a huge threat. So I just went off in a corner for 6 months to try to figure out how you can obtain sufficient data out of FDA in order to quantify or in some way illustrate the agency's needs. Because it was quite clear to all 33 of us that FDA was falling behind. But we couldn't, it's hard to put your finger on that. How do you, you know, make that come alive? What kind of information do you need? The first thing I did was to define the word science in a way that probably no scientist has ever thought of before. Namely, I said, science is everything FDA does. And I did that because there's a very thin line between the science, say, that a medical review officer uses to review a new drug application, and the science that a non-science trained inspector uses looking at a food product coming across the border from China and trying to figure out whether it meets the requirements of the statute and the regulations. It's a form of science. They're applying standards that at heart are scientific standards. After all, the diethylene glycol that contaminated the toothpaste coming in from China is the same diethylene glycol that in the fall of 1937, when used with sulfa, produced 120 deaths in 2 days and resulted in the new drug provisions of the act being put in the law in 1938. So I decided there were a couple of other problems and I will come to them, but basically I decided I had to put two pieces of the puzzle together. First, I had to somehow dramatize the responsibilities of the Food and Drug Administration today, which are just enormous. And it's hard to capture them all, but I had to find a way to put those together. Then I had to get some quantification of the resources and try to put those against each other. So that was great in terms of concept. The first half, actually, I think, was the easiest half. What I did was I used three surrogates for FDA's responsibilities. I did something that I've always wanted to do. I actually went back to 1897 and documented every statute that has ever been enacted by Congress that deals directly with the responsibilities of the Food and Drug Administration. In the report, I only put in the statutes for the last 20 years, because if I put them in for the entire time period from 1897, there wouldn't have been room for anything else in the report. But that was the first thing. And what I discovered actually showed that over the years, I had been inaccurate. I used to say up until now that the Food and Drug Act had been amended about 100 times since it was enacted in 1938. I now know it's over 225 times. Think of that. Think of what, if you're a government administrator and you get 225 amendments of your statute, that's more than the IRS has ever seen. It's more than any other government agency in history has ever seen. How do you grapple with that? What do you do to respond to it? In the last 20 years, which is the time period I chose for the report, that meant six new statutes a year. And we're not talking about small issues. Regulation of allergens in the food supply. Massive regulations. Large numbers of guidance. Guidance that still, today, have not been issued, as a matter of fact. The Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, which took an entire subset of the food supply and wrote entire new requirements relating both to labeling and, in addition to that, to safety, an entirely new safety standard that had never been in statute before. These are things, these are huge issues, and they come at you six a year. So that's why I put Table 1 in, which was the list, simply the list. Because saying there are, during that time period, 125 statutes, that doesn't tell you anything. You just say, oh, well, 125 statutes. Listing them page after page after page makes an impact. Pure theater, admittedly, and on purpose. But I didn't stop there, because many people forget, and many people in Congress forget, that all of the general statutes that apply to all government agencies have a huge impact. I use in the report the example of the Freedom of Information Act, because FDA receives more FOI requests every year than any agency except the FBI. Now think of the drain on the resources. They are currently 4 years behind in responding to FDA, to FOI requests. And they've cut their staff on the FOI requests. Why? Priorities. Their first priority ought to be public health and safety. So when Congress cuts their resources, the first thing they stop doing are administrative tasks that otherwise the country thinks are very important. Ask a reporter what she thinks about the fact that she can't get information about today's issue if she files an FOI request for 4 years. What are you going to do? Wait for 4 years to write the newspaper article? Now that's just one minor, very minor example. I use the example of rulemaking. Whenever FDA has to write a regulation, and they hate to do it, Dick and I spent most of our time at FDA writing regulations. Why? Because I refused ever to send a single regulation to OMB or to the Department of HHS. I just simply didn't do it. I just forgot every time. I used to get telephone calls about it. I would say, oh, yes, I'll remember the next time. And never did. Again, they could have fired me. You know how much I was worried about that. But today, you have to put in the preamble. I'll never remember all of them. I'll remember my favorite. But you have to put in the preamble a cost-benefit analysis, an environmental analysis, an analysis of the impact on small business, an unfunded mandate to the states analysis, and several others. But I discovered one actually doing this research that I hadn't heard of. There is a statute, I think FDA hasn't heard of it either, that requires you to have an analysis of the impact on family well-being. The one thing I like about food and drug laws, you don't have to make up jokes. I mean, they're inherent in the system. Dick, have you ever heard of that one? No. Well, I didn't dare ask FDA if they had ever heard of it. But this is an example of what happens. Congress is so intent on writing these impediments to regulation that the agency can't do its business. So it has to hire now economists. It has to hire experts in family well-being. It has to hire experts in environmental impacts. And those are people who ordinarily would be standing at the border stopping diethylene glycol in toothpaste, or would be reviewing new drug applications and getting life-saving drugs on the market faster. Instead, they're writing environmental impact statements. Another example of these broad requirements put out by Congress. Then there's a third one. Namely, the executive orders. I actually called up a couple people in my law firm to say, what is the authority of the president to write an executive order that is mandatory, absolutely mandatory, as binding as a statute on a government agency? It turns out that no one is quite certain about what that authority is, but the only place they could find an answer, Dick, was in your administrative law casebook, where you apparently have four pages that discuss it and say, we're not sure.
No, we don't say that.
Other people are not sure. Okay. The classic academic answer. But it's very interesting. But I'll guarantee you one thing. FDA has never, never knowingly violated an executive order. Those are regarded, if anything, as more important than a statute. And they impose more and more of these kinds of requirements. There's no need to go into any detail. That gives one element of the responsibilities of FDA. But it's a very visual, dramatic element that people can just look at the pages and charts and so on and say, good Lord, we had no idea. Even I didn't have any idea. And I've been in this field for Lord knows how many years. But then what I did, and I would like you, particularly you students, to draw your attention to pages 10 to 12 of the report. I took 10 programs that had been mandated by Congress and showed how none of the 10 had been completed by FDA because of lack of resources. And I'll just give you one, because it's one of my favorites. It's a program that is lost in the ancient time because it's so old. In 1962, you'll remember, with thalidomide, well, there was a one-sentence provision in that regulation, or in that statute, which said as follows: new drug applications that had come on the market between 1938 and 1962 on the basis of safety alone, just a review of safety, those new drug applications would remain effective for a two-year period. And at the end of that two-year period, each of the applicants would need to get an approval based on the new statutory standard that applied after 1962, namely proof of safety and effectiveness. 2 years. As of today, that is not yet implemented. That was 1962. That's a long time ago. There are still 20 drugs out there for which FDA has not been able to resolve the final issue of effectiveness. That isn't the worst one. The color additive amendments of 1960 require that FDA review the safety of every color additive used in a food, drug, cosmetic, or medical device. There is still an entire category of color additives now that we're 48 years later that have not been reviewed. I won't go through each one of the 10 programs, but I think if you students just read through those, you begin to understand the difficulties of a federal agency, which after all has to set priorities. Is it more important to look at the most, actually the oldest color additive that's been in the food supply and cosmetics and drugs for 102 years, is it more important to do that? After all, nobody seems to have died from it at the moment. Or is it more important to have one more inspector at the border? Think about this. We have 326 ports in the United States through which we import foods, drugs, cosmetics, and medical devices. 326, including tiny little airports, because every congressperson likes to have an, quote, international, quote, airport within their jurisdiction. FDA doesn't have enough inspectors to put one in every port. Now, you're the commissioner. What are you going to do? Put someone in one of those ports, or have them review the last color additive? This is the kind of question that FDA has to deal with. And I put those 10 examples in there to demonstrate what the practical impact is of the lack of resources, that the agency can't even complete the most basic, fundamental mandate of Congress to review the safety of marketed products. The third one was pretty simple, and that was, let's take a look at the enforcement statistics. Because enforcement is a job of the FDA field force. There are inspectors in every city in the United States. And they are the people who go into the factories, they go into retail grocery stores and take samples. They are what I testified before Congress on this yesterday. They are the heart of the agency. After all, they're in the front line. The people in Washington are reviewing applications and reports and things of that kind. The people out in the field are out there protecting you and me every day. Now, if there aren't enough of them, enforcement and compliance are going to go down. And what my statistics showed were that enforcement has become almost trivial. It's just remarkable. One of my favorite statistics, back when FDA was a law enforcement agency with about between 400 and 500 employees, they every year would bring 2,000 seizures and 600 criminal actions. Think about that, 500 people in the whole agency, both in headquarters and the field, bringing that enormous number of court actions, which aren't easy to bring. You've got to work with the Department of Justice, you've got to send all the court documents out, and at the same time, 500 people running the agency and doing all that work. Today, we have 12,000 people. Last year, they did not bring a single criminal action, and they brought 6 seizures. Now, what they have begun to do, of course, is to move from the courts into administrative compliance action. But even there, in fact, I'll tell you a funny story. I put in the draft the actual enforcement statistics of judicial enforcement. And I got this email back from an irate FDA reviewer, because it was reviewed by FDA before I put it in final form, saying, "You aren't paying attention to our informal methods of compliance. Warning letters have gone up." Well, I happen to have the statistics on warning letters. Warning letters have gone down. So to satisfy him, I put the statistics on warning letters in. He did not write me back after I did that. This is a way to dramatize the responsibilities on FDA and their inability to meet those responsibilities. When you turn to the resources side, then, here are the responsibilities, and here is the degradation, the disintegration of the agency in handling those responsibilities. How do you quantify the resources? You would think that this is the easy part. Well, let me tell you, this was the most difficult, and I will tell you why. First of all, FDA has no historical database on appropriations. None. Zero. The most they could hope for was to go back 10 years, they told me. It seems impossible. As I state in the report, this is an agency that's been around now 102 years, officially. But it has no way of managing from year to year with a consistent appropriations database. That's the first thing. Now, the second thing is that statistics are kept in the federal government on budget in 6 different ways. And although I have budget statistics going back to 1862, I once foolishly compiled them all, they're not kept the same way every year. And therefore, if you just take what comes out of an FDA report on any given year, that may be apples, and the next year may be oranges, and the third year may be pears. You have no way of knowing how to compare them. The next problem is that the way the numbers are kept, they include both the number for the center for foods, the center for drugs, etc., and the field force combined, so that the field force is divided up into foods, drugs, cosmetics, just the way the headquarters bureaus are. And they didn't know how to divide between those, how to split them up. The next problem was that since 1992, FDA has had user fees. They couldn't in every instance, could in some, but not all, divide between the user fees and the appropriated funds. Moreover, those user fees are divided among the center, the field, and another center, and the Office of the Commissioner. So they're divided four ways for drugs. And there was no way that they knew how to do that. Finally, even though this is the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, they could not separate out cosmetics, which are regulated in the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. So I had a small problem. How could I make something out of all of this? Well, they gave me what they could give me, but they emphasized one thing, and this is a fundamental a principle in the federal government, and it's one that most people don't understand. They are prohibited from giving anyone outside the agency any budget information except what is publicly available. They kept using the word publicly available. They cannot tell us on the committee what their request to the president was as opposed to what the president put in the budget. They are required to defend the president's budget as adequate, even as the agency is falling apart. They have to go before Congress and say, we have all the money we need, and we don't need any people either, even if that is demonstrably ridiculous, which, of course, it was. So the best that they could do was they gave me what they felt they could give me under that. I then went back to all my reports and statistics and simply did the best I could do with coming up with charts 4 and 5, tables 4 and 5, statistics. That terrified them because they realized that what I was going to put out to the public as the actual figures were not the actual figures. And therefore, rather than allow me to put out false information, which would be attributed to them, they sat down and began to do some work. And through, I would say, daily discussion for 3/4 of a year that culminated at exactly an email, the last email I got with the most recent data was 11 minutes after 8 p.m. on the Friday night that the report was due. I finally got some of the remaining information. The result is tables 4 and 5, to the best of anyone's knowledge, are the only 20-year consistent historical database of FDA appropriations that has ever been generated. It was, I will tell you, difficult. Now, what do they reveal? And they're pretty good data, actually, what we were finally able to obtain. The first thing is, if you take a look at 1994 to the present, FDA has lost 1,311 employees. And during that loss of those employees, of course, there were well over 100 statutes enacted telling them to do various things. And at the same time they were losing the employees, the FDA budget lost $300 million to inflation because the president wanted to keep a relatively stable budget during this time of budgetary difficulties. And that meant if you keep, well, I don't need to give you basic economics, if you keep a steady budget at a steady level, you lose somewhere between 4 and 6% every year to inflation. FDA calculates that amount as 5.8% per year, and they have detailed data. That they would tell me. Their fully burdened cost of living every year is 5.8% on average. So that's what they were losing. You know, 5 to 6% every year that the budget was kept level. But the most important thing that came to light, and this has startled everybody who has, it startled me. I had never looked at it this way, and I will just give you a little bit of personal background. One of my partners, Bruce Kulick, who's now General Counsel of Merck, and I drafted the first prescription drug user fee statute in 1992 for the pharmaceutical industry. And we put in there what we called the Plimsoll line. That is that Congress, that the industry did not want to wind up paying for everything. And therefore, as user fees went up, the rest of that Congress had to incorporate in the FDA appropriations an increasing amount at the same rate. It had to be indexed. And that would mean that the same ratio that applied in 1992 would apply to the future. Now, that's great in theory, and it worked for drugs. But what it meant was, you have user fees starting here and going up like that, and so you had the indexed appropriated funds for drugs only for drug review of drugs, not for the field force, also going up like that. Now, put that inside a flat budget. What does that mean for the Center for Foods? That means for the Center for Foods that they start like this and go down like that. And the same for the Center for Veterinary Medicine and Medical Devices. So that what user fees were doing was destroying the agency. It was making it into a land of the haves and the have-nots within each individual center. For example, in the Center for Drugs, the number of drug reviewers was increasing. The number of people in compliance were being decimated because they weren't supported by user fees. And outside the Center for Drugs, what we discovered, of course, was the Center for Foods in particular was disintegrating before our very eyes. They lost 15% of their force within the last 15 years. 15% of their workforce. And these are the people, of course, responsible for presenting or preventing what we've seen in the newspapers for the last 2 years. You know, E. coli and lettuce and tomatoes and peanut butter, botulism in canned food, and so on and so forth. This is why. There was nobody tending the store because Congress did not give them the resources. Now, we also looked into other things like the need for IT. FDA's system of IT within the agency it's not antiquated, it's medieval. For a long time, they couldn't even communicate with emails. It was so bad. I think they finally fixed that. None of the centers can communicate in terms of data comprehension with any of the other centers because they all use different systems. It's a situation that is impossible to understand. There are no travel funds. As a result, none of the FDA employees could attend scientific meetings. So, of course, they fell further and further behind their academic brethren and the people at NIH and CDC. Now, at the same time that FDA was going downhill, NIH budget went up 15-fold, from 2 billion to 30 billion. And the CDC went up fourfold, from one to 5 billion. And FDA was left behind. I got asked at the hearing the other day, why? It's a good question. I wish I knew the answer. The final thing was the impact on the field force. After 9/11, FDA was given 650 new inspectors for the border, which wasn't enough, but nonetheless was sort of a good start. Today, 5 years later, they're all gone. FDA didn't support them. I'm sorry, Congress did not support them. Congress, every year, cut the budget so that by this year, none of those inspectors are left. They've all gone. This is what is happening to the agency. Now, what has occurred as a result of this? Obviously, a tremendous amount of publicity. A congressional hearing, among other things. And the members of Congress who heard it fortunately reacted the way I had hoped. The greatest danger in this area is to make this a partisan issue. Republicans versus Democrats. In my report, I emphasized that there was no partisan politics involved here, that both Clinton and Bush were equally culpable. Neither one of them supported FDA. And that any support that was to come in the future had to be a bipartisan effort in order to avoid politics entering into it. Every member of the House committee, this was before the House O&I, Oversight and Investigations Committee of the Energy and Commerce Committee, everyone there agreed with me this was not a partisan issue. One of the most interesting things that came up in the hearing and the biggest trap was as follows, and I'd be interested in some of you students reacting to this. You've heard what the rule is. The president doesn't allow members of FDA to say that the budget is inadequate. Representative DeLorio, who is the chair of FDA's Appropriations Committee, has said, I will not give 1 cent more until I have a full realistic budget from FDA. That's never going to happen. Never. They won't be allowed to do it. The committee proposed to the commissioner that he come back in 60 days tracking all of our recommendation and putting a dollar sign next to it. At that point, I raised my hand and I said, you're asking the impossible. He can't do that. You know he can't do that. And the committee sort of backed down from that. But it reminded me of a quotation from a very close friend of Dick and mine, Don Kennedy. And this quotation was read to the committee by the Congressional Research Service. Don Kennedy, former FDA commissioner and then president of Stanford, said this at a congressional hearing after he had left FDA. He said to the committee, I hope you and your staff will be diligent about pursuing FDA resource needs. But you may have to rely on grizzled veterans like me because budget authorities at HHS and OMB specifically prohibit present officials in the agency from speaking out publicly about the need for more funding. So Don laid it right on the table. It won't work that way. Now, Representative DeLorio says, this was the best moment. This was my favorite moment in the hearing. When I raised this objection, the chair, Congressman Stupak, said, well, we've got to get the president to change his mind. And at that point, I responded, I don't think I can do that. And needless to say, just like you, they laughed. But it's a, that is a concern. It's the chicken or the egg. Which comes first? Now, if you're at FDA, you, sir, you're at FDA and you're commissioner, should you have the courage to say to the committee, I'm not supposed to do this, but I'll tell you exactly how much it's going to cost. If we want a realistic import system, it's going to cost an extra $100 million. We've costed it out. We know that's what it is. Would you be willing to do that?
Do I have cush job lined up in the private sector? I would think if you, I mean, you know, it just would depend on your personal priorities, but it would be, it seems like it would be in the best interest of FDA long term.
It would be in the best interest of FDA, but I thought the way the government was supposed to run is the president sets the policy and everybody he appoints implements it. You, sir.
I mean, it seems like that would be an opening for disaster unless you were really sure you were going to get a lot of press and a lot of backing from the press. It seems like, you know, by doing something you weren't supposed to do, you give yourself an opportunity to get the president really pissed at you and then start getting even less in your appropriations and also getting backstabbed in countless ways that are really hard to show, but that, you know, the president's office can easily do. It seems like the only answer to that question is I'm not legally authorized to answer that question.
Well, there we have it, the whole debate, right in front of our very eyes. Actually, though, let me challenge you on that. The head of NIH testified in favor of stem cell research about 6 months ago. I don't recall him being fired.
I mean, right now, definitely, the current president is a bit more vulnerable and doesn't want to screw over his party. But I wouldn't necessarily want to be that guy if the Republicans keep power with someone sympathetic to Bush in, you know, about a year.
Would you have a little more strength knowing that he's a lame duck and that if he fires you, he won't find another commissioner at this stage of the game in his administration? Would that give you some courage?
Yeah, and I think it would make it even easier that it's not too hard to tell the story in a way that's going to get a lot of public appeal. I mean, everyone's, you know, you can tell the story about the food that's coming into people's homes and immediately get a lot of attention and just talk about some of the things that have already gotten attention, like the contamination scandals. And so I don't think it would be that hard to get enough public attention on with a weak president. Just, you know, if he tried to kick you out immediately, everyone's going to be all over him to fix the problem, and Congress would get involved and solve. So I don't think it would be as difficult as it seems.
Are there opinions? Anybody else want to tackle this? It's a very interesting question. It involves fundamental philosophy about a democratic government. You know, as I said, political science theory is very clear. The president runs the executive branch and the people who he appoints are to follow his direction. And if they don't, get rid of them.
Press conference idea is very appealing to me. I mean, it just seems like if someone is really speaking up in the agency's best interest with compelling data to back them up and gets the publicity they need to get the message across, I think the president's policy aside, he's going to be in a really tight bind to fire him because of it.
Yes, but the president has fired people for doing those kinds of things. And do you want to be the person who's pilloried in the press for being fired by the president and hanging their head in shame before a dozen television cameras?
Will there be much shame to hang your head in if you stood up and did what needed to be done for the agency and there was a private...
Good question.
Lawyer.
Particularly because we gave him cover to do that. He could just say, look, 33 people just said this. You know, it'd be very... That we gave him that cover. Just 1 second, I'll tell you what he did.
Well, I'm just curious why he wouldn't just do the good old-fashioned thing and pretend to say nothing and leak it to the press.
Or that.
Yeah, but see, that doesn't get you anywhere. What you need is you need to go to Congress and say, here are the figures, I stand behind them, we can fix the problem with this amount of money. We can fix this problem. The IT will take $500 million, the import will take $100 million, the domestic inspection program will say take $200
million. If it works that well, if it would work that well to say that to Congress, and that would actually cause changes, why doesn't it work at all to say that to any number of presidents? Like, what is it about Congress that makes them more receptive to arguments like that than presidents?
Look, the president, you know what he's been doing the last 6 months. He's been vetoing spending bills. And he right across the board, no matter how, you know, how many people are standing in front of the White House weeping, he says, I got to hold the line on spending. And that's, among other things, his deep, both philosophical and economic position. It's not because he's heartless. He believes that's the best thing for the country.
This is a naive question, I'm sure, but if Congress knows the state of affairs here with the president's policy and the commissioner's bind, and they have the word of 33 other qualified scholars who said this, and it seems really like a no-brainer, why do they have to hear it from the horse's mouth in order to do something about it?
Well, that's, of course, what I said to them. But here's what happened. You remember back at the beginning I said we were told not to get into the budget and appropriations. So the committee, while the full committee did an analysis, a rough analysis, very rough, because you can't do a zero-based budget when the agency won't tell you what you need to know. I put in a ballpark figure and said over the next 2 years we've got to double the FDA budget and increase the FTE personnel by 50%. And I can justify that in broad general terms, but they are exceedingly broad and very, very general. Now, is that enough for Congress? No, it's not going to be enough for Congress. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just kept thinking that in terms of doing something like this, it falls into the charitable time when, at this point, like, I feel like in people's personal lives, you know, there's like the middle class crutch. It's like everyone's suffering and everyone needs tax cuts and that sort of thing. And that's really what's being pushed through. And I feel like coming through, and I understand the problem, but coming through right now may not be the best time. If it could wait a year or two, maybe under a new presidency, that maybe some things would get kind of turned around. And if there was more money to spend, and people didn't have this, you know, crunch all the time attacking them, this is all very optimistic thinking, of course, that there might be more support. So I feel like in broad theoretical terms, it makes sense until it comes down to people's pocketbooks. I don't know that people are going to get behind it as much as they would when it's just broad, when you're talking about, you know, broad problems.
Well, if we keep going the way we're going, we're going to have more E. coli and salmonella contamination. We're going to have more dangerous drugs to deal with and more defibrillators that don't work, etc., because FDA can't inspect those manufacturing facilities. There's a statutory requirement that every drug and device firm be inspected at least once every 2 years. That isn't done. And the industry knows it isn't done. Yes?
If it is this crisis and these people at FDA want to get the information possibly, are unable to because they're part of the executive branch and serve at their own budget, shouldn't people be leaving the FDA kind of an exodus there?
They are.
And then they should be speaking out. But I mean, it's also part of the executive branch that doesn't like it.
Well, is that going to make the headlines in the newspapers? Well, the commissioner isn't going to leave. He's a personal friend of the president. That's how he became commissioner. He was an MD at MD Anderson in Houston, and a friend of the Bush family for many years. He first became the head of the National Cancer Institute. He didn't want to go to FDA. He's an oncologist. And so he went kicking and screaming to the agency. He's not, and then he's certainly not going to embarrass his old friend the president by, you know, speaking out against him. Go ahead.
Aren't you asking him to do just that?
Yes.
I don't see how you could just want to do that.
I think there are ways that he could do it. And I think there are ways that lots of people in FDA to do it. When my commissioner, Charlie Edwards, and I were there, we did speak out on these issues. There's one famous hearing where Edwards, cross-examined about the field force, said, no, we can't do the job. That's all you got to say is, with this number of inspectors, do the arithmetic. 326 ports and, you know, 200 inspectors. You don't have to say much more than that. We aren't inspecting what's coming in. We are not inspecting the factories in India and China that are making our drugs today. We aren't inspecting them. If that's what you want, then fine. That's what we said. We testified and we got away with it. Of course, we had a secretary of HEW at that time, Elliot Richardson, who believed in that kind of thing. We were very fortunate. Now, here is what... I'm sorry, sir.
I wanted to ask you the extent to which you think the failure or the relative failure of FDA compared to NIH in the appropriations process can be explained by the role of patient advocacy groups.
I don't think that's it. But there is a good explanation. You touch one penny in the NIH budget, and you're going to hear from every scientist in the country, because that's where they get their money every day, grants and contracts from NIH. Moreover, where are those scientists located? In every congressional district in the country. So they all en masse write their local member of Congress, the House and the Senate. They can put on more pressure than you can conceivably imagine. With regard to CDC, it's the same thing. The entire virology community descends on Congress every year. And what do they talk about? If we don't have new vaccines, little kids are going to die. It's a pretty compelling argument, and they win. FDA doesn't have that kind of constituency. How many people in this room have ever written a member of Congress and said, increase the FDA appropriations? That's a rhetorical question. You don't feel embarrassed. But the fact is, it doesn't occur anywhere. Now, here is what the commissioner did, and then we're over time. I apologize, Mimi. But here is what the commissioner did. He waffled, completely waffled. He said he agreed with the reports. They were very good reports. But he did not accept that FDA was not doing a good job. That FDA was out there on the front line every day protecting the public. That of course they could do a better job. If they got more resources, they would increase their excellence. Okay. So he felt compelled to defend his colleagues in the agency. And I can understand that. I have sympathy for that. I wish that he had said, this is an accurate picture. You can see we're suffering. And it's going to get worse unless something happens. Fortunately, nobody in Congress listened to him. And they went away saying, this is indeed a real problem. And that was the purpose of the report. And it was the reason to go back to the beginning. And it illustrates how a report like this isn't worth the paper it's written on if it's just a bunch of dead words. I used more adjectives and adverbs in that report than I would use in a normal year. I wanted this to be a cry of outrage, you know, a call to action, something that people would pick up and say, I can't believe it's that bad. And that's the way it hit Congress. It wasn't the excellent analysis of IT needs, which are horrendous, and which underlie many of the problems. It was the dramatization. It was creating theater. That's what you got to do if you're going to get the attention of Congress, at least in my judgment. And so far, we succeeded in that. And we got a congressional hearing, which I had thought was a long shot. Well, I hope you enjoy a little bit of the narrative of how this all unfolded. We don't know how it's going to go from here. Call me when you read the 2009 budget proposal put up in a couple months by the president. Or better yet, call the president. Thank you so much.